Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
So now we'll go around the room in order to introduce ourselves. And then we'll ask anybody who's here for the first time to introduce themselves better. After Shantanu speaks, we have another half an hour social period. And if anybody's here for the first time, we'd like to welcome you and make you feel welcome. So, is there anybody here for the first time?
John Azzolini, I'm Richard's brother, and I'm visiting from Maryland.
Hi, John.
Hi, Bob Agee, friend of the day of Sir.
Peggy Nackers, friend of Shantanu's.
Jennifer Reisendahl, also a friend of Shantanu's.
I am Joseph Rudera, son of Oswaldo Garcia.
And now we'll go through the room and introduce ourselves. I'm Peter.
I'm Kay Matsuda.
My name's Greg.
John Wessel.
Robert.
My name is Tony Ponsco.
Bruce.
Hey, Manuel.
David.
Henry Ravinowitz.
Jerry.
I'm Roy.
I'm Jim.
My name is Ray Diver.
Peter.
My name is John.
I'm Tom Drouin.
My name is Jerry Jones.
Anthony.
Hello.
My name is Michael.
Leor.
Andreas.
And Jimmy Brown.
And Brian.
Jesse.
My name is T.H. Longia.
I'm Clint.
Richard Azzolini.
Jack.
Tom Morrissey.
I'm Schmink.
George.
Joseph Rudera.
Baruch.
I'm Peter.
I'm Shantanu.
Francisco.
My name's Harley.
Eric Anderson.
So now, Shantanu Phukan will lead us in this talk. Do you want to just introduce yourself?
Sure. So, well, that was the longest half hour of me. all the more so because Peter Camarda has been telling me about the dangers of talking to a group as combative as this. But I was nervous, not primarily for that reason, but my main concern was when Jim Stewart asked me to talk to this group several months ago. And my main concern was that I have felt a bit of an interloper because I'm not a Buddhist, and in fact Buddhism hasn't played a very big part in my imaginative life. So I should tell you right away that this is not going to be a talk about Buddhism at all. And then I talked with Jim about this, and also with Ray, and came to realize that what I can talk about is the things that have been meaningful to me in my spiritual life, and meditation is certainly one of them, which is one of the things that brings me back to this group pretty much every week these days. So there's that, but there's also I can talk well, the spiritual life is really a flight from meaninglessness and into meaning and substance and richness, and I would say even pleasure. And those are all things that I certainly can talk about. And I wanted to thank both Jim and Ray for bringing me to that point. So on that, on the issue of pleasure and meaningfulness and richness and joy, the thing that there are many sources of richness and joy, or there are several sources in my life. Watching birds is one. It has been since I was about 11 or 12 years old, and Jennifer, who's sitting here in the back of the room, has been one of my partners in birding. I think we visited about 11 or 12 states at this point. And gardening is another. And cooking. God knows cooking. But I'm not going to talk about any of those three things, but the thing that I will concentrate on today is poetry, which has also been a source of richness and pleasure, and not just reading poetry, but also translating poetry. So I will be reading you my translations. Mostly a Rumi from Persian into English, and also of Muhammad Iqbal from Urdu into English. Rumi, I think you have all heard about. 13th century poet who, had he lived in the world that we live in, would be a Turk. He spent most of his life in central Anatolia and Turkey, and is buried in Konya, in the town of Konya. But as was the custom in his day and in Turkey, wrote in Persian, not in Turkish. So he was part of the Turkish, part of the Persian-speaking world, as India has been also for the last 600-700 years. So Indians, until very recently, wrote in Persian. There's more Persian literature from India than there is from Iran. And Turkey formed the western end of this Persianate world. India formed the eastern end. So Rumi you have heard about. Muhammad Iqbal you may not have heard about. Muhammad Iqbal is the originator of the idea of a separate homeland for the Indian Muslims, that is Pakistan. So he is greatly loved in Pakistan, and on the other side of the border in India is a persona non grata. But as far as Urdu literature goes, he is a force to contend with. But more appropriately for this talk, he was a, one could say, a lover, worshipper of Rumi. And in fact chose to be buried in the town of Konya. And his tomb is right outside Rumi's tomb, in the same tomb complex as Rumi's. And this is, in fact, a very surprising thing, because Iqbal was a modernist poet. So this would be a bit like, you know, W.H. Auden choosing to be buried in St. Peter's or something. Nonetheless, Iqbal was a great lover of Rumi's, and one of the poems that I want to read to you, and actually Peter and I will read together, is called A Pilgrim's Plea, and it is Iqbal taking on the persona of a pilgrim who is about to make a pilgrimage to the tomb of Rumi and is pleading his case as he's about to step into the tomb complex and around the grave of Rumi, which is the, and then to kiss the tomb of Rumi, which is the conventional way of performing the pilgrimage to a saint's tomb, not to Kaaba, but to the saint's tomb. And so this will give you an idea of the esteem in which Rumi has been held, not just in Turkey, not just in the Persian-speaking world, but even in the modern Urdu, Hindi-speaking world of India. So let me begin with pilgrims. And were you beginning this? Okay, just give me a second. All right, so throughout this poem, this is Muhammad Iqbal speaking as a pilgrim, and he's speaking about Rumi, but also to Rumi, addressing him over time.
The name that angels whisper, that is your name. Wide is your embrace, and grand indeed your grace. Spellbound by you is love, as stars by sun. A step around your grave is a step within, such heights at which you dwell, higher than Jesus. Such shades of love you hide in your one love.
If I am cursed, O Lord, with a burned black heart, then know, my Lord, it is the one chance scar that stains the silken core of any tulip. And if instead I'm blessed as the opened tulip, then know, my Lord, your warmth has kissed it open.
I am that exiled scent that, like all scents, must waft in fickle winds, at home nowhere, though longing every second for the rose that gave it birth.
Or else I'm rooted, leafless, parched, and waiting, patient as the forlorn desert tree that skies the heavens for a wispy cloud and spurns the gardener with his watering can.
Or else I sit in splendor holding court as the sun outshines the stars arrayed in heaven.
Or else I outpace all those who walk with me in life's long journey, outpace to such a length that reaching me, they think me to be the longed-for journey's end.
Grant just this much, O Lord, that the words of this poor poet may wound the heart of none upon this earth, and yet, like a cruel, shining saber, may those words pierce every heart that hears.
And also this, my Lord, that the saint who shines like a candle in the court of martyred Ali, the saint whose breath has opened up my heart, that tight-lipped rose, whose grace has made of me the king of verse, grant that I step just once around his tomb.
And also this, my Lord, that the second Joseph, that flame of love who scorched me till there was no dregs of you or I remaining,
who lavished me with this my second youth, grant that he stays smiling in this autumn garden we call the world. May my sullen heart be open and smiling. May this pilgrim's plea be found not wanting. And one more by Iqbal. I have, speaking of joy and richness, probably the richest time that I have spent was the time I spent in India in 94, 95, recording this poetry, recited and also sung, and having a friend of mine who's a singer, he's an Indian singer of Indian music, putting much of this poetry that has not been sung to music. And so Jyoti and I sat down for hours and we would try out different melodies and we would he would sing and I would, you know, talk about the singing and we would sort of go back and forth. So here is a poem that will be the segue into Rumi. It's also by Iqbal. It's a quatrain. And it's about poetry and music, poetry and dance, and poetry and pleasure. So the Urdu text first, and then the English. Sher se roshan hai jaan jibril o ehraman رقص موسیقی سے ہے سوز و سرور انجمن فاش یوں کرتا ہے ایک چینی حکیم اسرار فن شیر گویا روح موسیقی ہے رقص اس کا بدن. The couplet is the fuel and ablaze are both the devil and Gabriel. The couplet is the fuel and ablaze are both the devil and Gabriel. And the force of music is the spark of every gathering. Thus reveals the beloved the truth of every art and skill. The couplet is the very soul of music and dance its outer skin. The couplet is the very soul of music and dance its outer skin. And what Rumi is talking about is the performance of this poetry, of the kind of poetry that we just heard in the Pilgrim's Plea. The genre of poetry is called the ghazal, G-H-A-Z-A-L. It's the ghazal is a lyric poem, and like all lyric poetry, it takes its theme, its true subject, its center is loss. Loss, as Iqbal himself once said, the only theme of life is what remains of the beloved. And the lyric, the ghazal, takes that loss as its main theme. But the ghazal was also performed. It has always been performed in gatherings very much like this, in rooms very much like this. They exist still in Turkey. Rooms with wooden floors, rooms which are round, rooms in which the audience sits in a circle around the Sufi sheikh who recites the poetry and is recited to. And the goal of this recitation is not to give in to ecstasy, but to hold back from ecstasy, to hold back from having your limbs move. So our response to rhythm, our response to music, is to move in rhythm to it. And what these recitals ride on is the tension between wanting to move and keeping yourself from moving until the ecstasy becomes unbearable. And then you give in. It's a bit like speaking in a Quaker meeting house. Yes, one should be open to the spirit, but if one is being moved to speak all the time, that is not such a good thing. So this is what Iqbal is talking about. Dance, poetry and music, poetry and dance, dance and pleasure. So the poetry that I'm going to read, what all have been recited in recitals in rooms very much like this, and the circle would have consisted of students of a Sufi sheikh who would be at the center of the room, like the Buddha, and the students would try very hard not to go into ecstasy and then give in when it became unbearable. And Rumi's, and Iqbal is still positioned as a student of Rumi's in his grave, around his tomb. Let's see. So, since this talk is also a little bit about me, I should say, you know, why is it that this poetry means as much as it does to me? I come to it from having, well, as the grandson of my grandfather, who was a great lover of the ghazal. And one of my earliest memories, one of the most fondest memories I have, this is in Calcutta when I was growing up, is that every evening around 10 p.m., so pretty late in the evening, and this is a story even you have not heard. Every evening at around 10 p.m., All India Radio would begin a broadcast of just ghazals. And my grandfather, who lived in a room by himself, he lived in the house that we all lived in, but he lived in a room by himself. And although you could go in and out of his room, at that point, at 10 p.m., the doors closed and you couldn't go in, especially children could not go in. And he would lie, and he would send me out every evening with a rupee, and he would say, go and buy me some betel nuts. Do you know what betel nuts are?
Yes.
People chew them. They're a mild intoxicant. They also create a juice that is red. It's blood red. And this is very common in India and Southeast Asia. So he would send me out with a rupee and he would say, go buy me a handful of betel nuts and keep the change. And I would invariably buy a bottle of Coke with that. And this would be one of my rewards. The other reward was to spy on him. So the doors would in fact close. They couldn't be locked, but they could be closed. And I would come back and give him his betel nuts. He would start chewing them. He would turn on All India Radio at 10 p.m. And I would push the door open just slightly, and I would listen to this music. But I would also watch him. And he would be just in ecstasy. And he would be lying in the same pose that the historical Buddha lay in on his deathbed. In other words, his head propped up on his elbow. And he would be so rapt that as he chewed the betel nuts and as he went deeper and deeper into ecstasy, the betel juice would start to drip from the corner of his mouth and onto his vest. This is one of the fondest memories I have. I didn't know that I would grow up to actually read and even translate this poetry. Why poetry? Well, I think I can do no better than to quote C.S. Lewis, who said, he's not a big favorite of mine, but he did come out with some really wonderful statements on poetry, and one of them was, we read poetry in order to know that we are not alone. And it has been a great antidote to not loneliness, but aloneness, to the sense of being alone. Especially the last, I would say, 6 months, as my ability to garden and bird has subsided a bit because of a mobility issue that I have that has been growing the last 5 years, and some days it's better than others. But as that ability has declined, reading has certainly become more important, but translation has become more important also. Because translation is really like a reading poetry is like a conversation with across time, across space. But translating is a conversation that's much more intimate than simply reading is. So, you know, a bit about me, a bit about this genre of poetry that Iqbal and Ruby are both writing in. The strength of poetry comes, like for genies, it comes from being confined in a bottle. If there is no bottle, there is no game. If there are no parameters, then there can't be a game. Yes, you could play a baseball game with any number of bases, but we have four. Those are the rules by which we have to play if we are to play a meaningful game of baseball. And so some of the rules of the ghazal are conventions, you can call them, are that this is a poetry in couplets, which is why Iqbal is writing about the couplet being the fuel that sets both Gabriel and the devil ablaze with the fire or whatever. It's a poetry in couplets. It is end-rhymed. The rhyming The rhyme scheme is A-A-B-A-C-A-D-A. So in other words, the second line of the couplet rhymes with the other second lines of the couplet. So there's a great deal of unity of structure. And that is what the ghazal really relies on to pack its punch. Because there is hardly, or there doesn't have to be any unity of theme, other than the very loose one, which is ghazals are all about loss, loss of some kind, love or through death. But other than that, there is no unity of meaning. In other words, don't expect the ghazal to unfold like a narrative. First this happened, and then this, and then this, and this is the consequence of this. Because that just doesn't happen. It may happen. Just to keep things interesting, it may happen, but it doesn't have to happen. So don't expect unity of theme, but unity of structure there is. And that, unfortunately, is one of the things that has to go when you translate from either Urdu or Persian or Turkish into English. It's very easy to create the end rhyme in both English and Persian because they are verb final languages, so the verb comes at the very end, and the common verbs being to have, to be, etc. The end rhyme is very easy to create in English. It is almost impossible to create in... it's very easy to create in Urdu and Persian. Almost impossible to create in English without sounding stilted and forced. So that has had to go. But I am a believer in rhythm and repetition. Without that, there is no poetry. So what I've tried to do instead is to translate a poet who really exults and he revels in repetition. And Rumi is that poet. I will recite some, as I recite the poetry in Persian, you will see what I mean by creating rhythms through repetitions. Rumi is a great, Rumi, more than almost any other poet, does this. Another convention, you will see in a minute, another convention of the ghazal is that in the very last couplet, the poet usually works his pen name into that couplet, either by way of addressing himself or having the world address him or having the beloved address the poet as the lover or death addressing the speaker can be, there can be many speakers. And again, Rumi is unusual here in that Rumi does not use his pen name. Rumi didn't have a pen name, which is a really unusual thing for anyone writing within the Persian and Urdu or the Turkish ghazal tradition. All poets take on a persona by taking on a pen name that usually has to do with some aspect of love. So a pen name might be forlorn, or it might be put upon, or whatever. Rumi doesn't have one. Rumi uses instead the pen name of his beloved, who was a man by the name of Shams. The word means the sun, S-U-N, not S-O-N. And you can see the many possibilities here. The sun addressing the world addressing the sun, and of course in English translation, panem on sun as S-O-N and S-U-N. So there's another possibility in English that doesn't exist in Persian or Urdu. So Rumi uses the pen name of, not himself, but of Shams. So some things to watch out for in these translations, some themes that Rumi keeps coming back to again and again and again. Well, the first theme is a praise of Shams at his own expense. So setting himself up as Shams's beloved, which in fact was the case. Shams was his spiritual guide. Shams was his poetic guide. So Rumi would submit his poetry to Shams for correction. This is a time-honored, long tradition in the Persian world, men forging relationships with each other through the medium of poetry, men creating relationships by submitting their verse for correction to someone else, and then the hierarchy that sets up creates a bond. So Rumi had this relationship with Shem. So one of the themes that he is concerned with is himself and Shams. And you will see in many of the ghazals, the very last couplet comes around to him addressing Shams, Shams addressing him, the world addressing both Shams and him. The possibilities are many. So that's one. But the other theme, and if Rumi does have a pen name, it is silence. He often signs his, I don't just mean metaphorically, I mean quite literally, Rumi signing his, the last couplet of his verse with the words silence. So here's the irony. Here's a poet who goes on at great length, and in the very last couplet he comes, he chides himself for talking at all, for trying to put into words that would simply cannot be put into words, which is a dilemma that all mystics have faced. The ever-present quality of language and the complete inadequacy of language to contain the experience, which is always bubbling over, slipping out of bounds, never contained by the prison by the prison of words. So this is another theme that Rumi explores in all of his poetry, I would say, the theme of words and silence, words and limitations, words as limitation, language as limitation, and language as the great liberator of meaning also. It always helps to read a poem, a poet, through other poets. And this has been a concern of poets, this theme of language and limitation, language and liberation, language and freedom, language and imprisonment, the inadequacy of language has always been the theme of many poets. And because I can't resist, I will recite this poem by, this is my favorite American poet, W.S. Merwin, who won the Pulitzer Prize last year for his superb book, The Shadow of Sirius. Whether you read Rumi or not, you should read W.S. Merwin. And he is dealing with this exact same theme that Rumi will deal with. So I will recite this poem by Merwin, and then I will start reciting. People now will start reciting Rumi. So this poem is simply called Note. Remember how the naked soul comes to language. Remember how the naked soul comes to language and all at once discovers loss and distance and believing. Then, for a time, it will not run with its old freedom, like a light innocent of measure, but will hearken to how one story leads to another, and will try to tell where they have emerged from and where they're heading, as though they were its own legend, running before the words and beyond them, naked and never looking back, through the noise of questions. So naked soul, the soul before the day of creation, before the soul comes into language, it runs like a light, innocent of measure. And when it comes to language, it is contained within meaning, and it is also contained within a consciousness of desire. And as Merwin says, and all at once comes to distance and loss and believing. So these are the limitations that language imposes on the otherwise free and naked soul. And I have found this poem to be really useful for reading Rumi and understanding Rumi, because Rumi is dealing exactly with the same issue, loss, distance, and believing. This has been the one paradox that the Islamic tradition has dealt with from the get-go. The paradox of language, the necessity of language, and language creating a sense of otherness from, so the sense of self and the other, which dissolving that sense has been, that distance, that That distance has been the primary goal of much of the Islamic tradition. It's not something one knows about or hears about a whole lot, because you know what we hear about these days is Al Jazeera and Al Qaeda and Taliban and this, that, and the other. But this has been the animating concern of the Quran, the sense of separateness from the world. All right. So with that, with those themes in mind, loss and love, language and love, language and limitation, language as limitation, language as necessity, language as liberation. Let's start with some of the poetry that is about an experience that simply cannot be contained, that is always spilling over, that poets are always trying to harness and bring back into the prison of language. در چرخ سهرگاه یکی ماه آیان شد و از چرخ بزیر آمد و بر ما نگران شد چون باز که بر باید مرغی بگه سید بر بود مرا انمه و بر چرخ روان شد. Ravan shud is the rhyme. Got going, ran, made off. در خود چون نظر کردم خود را بندیدم زیرا که در ان ماه تنم از لطف چو جان شد با دادت مخدومی شمس الحق تبریز. Here is Rumi coming back in the last line to Shams. در دادت مخدومی شمس الحق تبریز نه ماه توان دیدن O Bahar Tawan Shud. And the translation. From the glow of dawn, a moon appeared. From the glow of dawn, a moon appeared. It swept from the skies, speared me with its eyes. With me in its talons, to the sky it soared, like a hawk which snatches a songbird by force. I glanced at myself. No me to be seen. The moon of mercy had paired my body to a soul. Formless I flew, seeing just the moon and the world lit in its gleam. Sky and then sky all merged with the moon. The raft that is me was drowned in the sea. Without the force of that sunburst of Shams, without the force of that sunburst of Shams, neither the moon nor the sea can be seen. From the glow of dawn, a moon appeared. It swept from the sky. It speared me with its eyes. So this is a poem about subtraction. This is a poem about a subtraction that is simultaneously an addition. And here's another one. And do keep in mind that, oh, here's one that I'll recite just the first two couplets of. And this will help you see what I mean by repetitions and rhythms and how Rumi is really the master of repetitions. The Persian. ای لولیان ای لولیان یک لولی دیوانه شد تفتش فتاد از بام ما ان سوی مجنون خانه شد ای لولیان ای لولیان یک لولی دیوانه شد تفتش فتاد از بام ما ان سوی مجنون خانه شد او جیپسیز او جیپسیز ا جیپسی went and lost his mind a gypsy lost his marbles fled screaming to the madhouse. O gypsies, a gypsy went and lost his mind. A gypsy lost his marbles, ran screaming to the madhouse. And now look at the second couplet. Just look at the image. He circled around the lake that's me, crazed with thirst and weak of mind. Like a dry and flaky piece of bread, he soaked up the water that is me. Now, where else in this entire tradition of Persian and Urdu poetry would you find a mention of a dry and flaky piece of bread? It just doesn't happen. And this is the great thing about Rumi, that he just he was not a professional poet. He was not bound by the kinds of rules and conventions that courtly poets would have to abide by. So courtly poets would never think of mentioning something as vulgar and as quotidian, as mundane, as a dry piece of bread soaking up water. And Rumi simply does not feel constrained by those rules. And this is one of the reasons why he is such a pleasure to translate. And also why he's easy to translate, because the repetitions are already there in Rumi. It's a matter of repeating the repetitions. A third ghazal by him. I'll just read the first couple of couplets in Persian. Ishqast dar azma paridan sad parde bahar nafas taridan awwal nafas az nafas gusastan akhir qadam az qadam buridan. Soaring through open skies is love. Shredding the veil with the breath is love. Checking the self with the self is love, and it's love that erases the footprint from every footfall. Grasping the world with no eyes is love, and love is to hold your gaze with no gaze. I say, O knocking heart, be blessed. Blessed your fall into the arms of lovers. Gazing at the landscape of the gaze is love. Scurry to the alleys of the heart is love. O self, from where comes this breath? O heart, from where comes this burn? And now you'll see what I mean with the next couplet, with a complete disjunction, complete lack of carryover in terms of meaning, although the rhythm and the structure is still repeating. So, O self, from where comes this breath? O heart, from where comes this burn? I lingered in the forge, my heart now claims, while a fire was kindled of water and clay. I lingered in the forge, this is the forge, the created world. The day of creation is the forge. I lingered in the forge, my heart now claims, while a fire was kindled of water and clay. At last, I fled from this forge of forms. The fire was not yet full nor warm. But I stumbled, and they dragged me by my legs. But I stumbled, and they dragged me by my legs. I bickered, but they slapped on me a face. I bickered, but they slapped on me a face. You can see this as the day of creation, God forging Adam, God forging Rumi, bestowing an identity on him, identity that is a limitation, and over which the poet, Adam, man, they all bicker and they all complain, but the face gets slapped on them nonetheless. So the theme of silence and bickering, words, language, and just one more, because Peter and I have practiced this, and let's see. The markings are he asked who's at the door.
It's me, your slave, I answered.
He asked me what I wanted.
To greet you, was my answer.
He asked how long this knocking.
Till you respond, I answered.
How long this restless gushing.
Till doomsday, was my answer.
And so I swore by my love, I sighed and pledged my all. You'll see that I am steady, love made me babble nonsense.
For a pledge you need a witness, also a judge, he quibbled.
My tears will bear witness, with a pallid face I answered.
The eyes not to be trusted, your witnesses are shallow.
But by your boundless justice they'll be redeemed, I answered.
What goal have you, he queried.
Just friendship and affection.
And what is it I give you?
Your favor is all I want.
Who came with you all this way?
Your thought, my king, I answered.
Who called you here, he asked me.
Your thought, my king, I answered. Who called you here, he asked me, the fragrance of your wine cup.
Disaster, Have you ever tasted it?
Your love is a disaster.
Then how will you tread that hard path?
With steady steps, I answered.
I've tested you enough, he grumbled. And what is it that I have gained?
Hush, forget this gabbing. If I reveal him through words, you'll burst beyond your own self. No door nor roof could hold you. There's really coming back to this issue of silence at the end of all of this restless gushing. So I think I'll stop at that. Is it time to stop?
Yeah.
All right. Well, then let me stop there. And any questions you have, any comments about it? I mean, these are translations that are in the works, so any reactions you have would be useful. David?
Mike? I have two questions, if I can. One is, it sounds as if poetry is to motivate the dancing, motivate an ecstasy which ultimately results in the dancing. Is the dancing the end all, or is the dancing supposed to elevate the consciousness somehow to...
Well, movement always elevates the consciousness, especially if it's rhythmic movement. So the goal of the dance is not the dance itself. The goal of the dance is, I guess, to shed your sense of yourself as... and to shed the sense of... what's the word? Decorum. And the paradox is that although the goal is to shed decorum, the dance is a highly prescribed dance, so that it's not shaking your limbs.
Spiritualized.
Well, it's not just spiritualized. I mean, the context is spiritual, but the movements are prescribed. So that's the paradox, that this is an attempt at shedding decorum, but the form through which you shed that decorum is highly conventionalized to begin with.
Okay, and one more question would be, talks about how translating verbally or communicating verbally is so inadequate and so restricted. Might that not perhaps speak to a uniqueness of the individual about which we have not yet grasped? That, so perhaps maybe it's not the language, perhaps it's the uniqueness of the individual experience. It doesn't really lend itself to verbal communication, which essentially communicates it fully.
No, completely. I mean, it's the experience that is incommunicable, and yet we make attempts to communicate it. And what do we have? What's the tool through which we keep coming back to? It's I would say a language. Now, musicians would jump up and down and say, no, that's not the only tool we have. There's also music, and this is an argument that Jennifer, you and I have. This is an argument that has been running for 25 years. But I would say that, yes, one of the things that we have as human beings is language, and it's inadequate. Inadequate to the experience of whichever individual.
Thanks. And thank you for your talk. It was very interesting.
It's fun. Yes?
I was fascinated by your account of your grandfather and wanted to, if you could say just a little bit more about what he was listening to at 10 o'clock. This was music on the radio?
Why don't I just play you a short snippet, since I have, the iPod here. And so I will play you Jyoti singing the very first quatrain by Iqbal. Couplet is the fuel and ablaze are both Gabriel and the devil. And so Jyoti and I sat down and we worked out this rendition of it. So I'll just play you that, and that'll answer your question better than any word scan. Okay, let's see if this works though.
शेर से रोशन है
Would be that it would have a rhythmic accompaniment to it. So it would have tabla, which Jyoti is playing the drone himself. But there was no tabla around, so we just recorded it with his voice, which I think actually works pretty well. But yeah, the music that he would listen to would be in this vein, mostly by women, not sung by men, because the tradition was to have this poetry performed by courtesans. They no longer exist. There are prostitutes now, but there are no courtesans. So the bulk of the recordings of the ghazal being sung are by women. So that would be the difference. But I mean, this is the kind of music that he would listen to and just go into ecstasies. And from 10 to 12 is when the show would run, and he would be gone with the Beetlejuice dripping down his mouth.
Shantanu, you're
going to
be
available
in
that
social hour.
I'm sorry.
What? You'll be here for social hour.
Yeah, I will be here
for more discussion.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And do we have any announcements this morning?
Yes, I just want to remind the Sangha that we have an account at Community Thrift, which is on Valencia near 17th. The building is painted various shades of traditional things you cannot visit. Last quarter we made about $235, so if you have anything that you no longer have use for and wish to donate it there, just tell them it's for GBF and we get a percentage of the profits, so it helps us fund our Sangha. So. They take donations from 10 to 5 every day, but you should check to see if what you're donating they accept, and a long list of things they don't, which don't seem necessarily obvious.
They will also pick up our guidance, because it's picked up.
Thank you.
We're going to be having our kind of annual picnic. This coming July 10th in Golden Gate Park. So if you want more details, you can just refer to the newsletter or go online or the newsletter there. But that's basically it. We try to have this every year. I think we missed it last year. But it's fun. People seem to enjoy it, so I encourage people to participate.
I just wanted to add, if you are interested in reading more about Rumi, I have a book. I have a couple of books here. And these translations are also, if you want, I'll just put them out there if you want to take a look at them.
Thanks, Shantanu, for coming today, and Peter for helping him. And I was kind of interesting, you were honoring your grandfather today on our American Father's Day, I thought.
Well,
he didn't get his pose in the...
Well, yeah, he was my father, really. Yeah.
Next week, our speaker is going to be Heather Sundberg. She was here probably 2 months ago. She's coming back, and she's from Spirit Pond.
Today's talk prompts me to recommend a film, Forest of Bliss. It's a new print, and it's showing at Berkeley this Wednesday, one time. They're essentially 90 minutes on the funeral ghats in Benares. There's no text, there's no music, there's no smells. It's just sight and sound, almost like going there for 90 minutes.
Do we have a host today?
Yes. Hi, everyone. My name is Tage Lillian, and I'm the host today. There's some orange cardamom coffee cakes, some macaroons, and fruit for your enjoyment. There's also tea. If you have tea, please wash your cup out with soapy water and put it in the dish rack. I'm going to be going around with the Donna Bowl, asking for donations, contributions to cover our expenses. The suggested donation is $5 to $8, more if you're able. There's a newcomer sign-up sheet. If you wish to receive our newsletter, please write down your street address and email address, please. And then finally, some members go out for lunch after the meeting, and the group usually meets out by the front door around 12:30.
Thank you. So also, in the month of July, on the 25th, there won't be a meeting that day. The center needs the space, so the last weekend in July, there's no meeting. And something new, would you like to take us out with a dedication of merit?
Yes, Commissioner.
By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness, which is without sorrow, and may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, and live believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month, and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.